Hello, and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental nerds, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, we give our shout-outs. Nick and I discuss how the internet runs through underwater cables. We interview Esri's chief scientist, Don Wright, which is just awesome.
Yeah.
Just stay tuned. You're going to love
it. So cool. Oh, man.
And finally, on this day in science, 1953, the journal Nature published a paper from Francis Crick and James Watson titled Molecular Structure of Nucleic Acids, a Structure for Deoxyribose Nucleic Acid, in which they describe a double helix structure for DNA.
Awesome.
Woo, nailed that, Nick. I didn't thought I'd mess that up.
That's why I made
it's
you do
pretty
this.
Cool. Yeah. Check it out. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Now hit that music.
Today's shout out goes to Jomar Maldonado for his new-ish job as the Associate Director for NEPA at the Council for Environmental Quality. Congrats, and looking forward to having him on the show, hopefully here in the future. Be sure to share your promotions, new jobs, professional and project awards with us here on the EPR website at www.environmentalprofessionalsradio.com. Also, don't forget, the NAEP conference is coming up May 17th through the 20th. One of the cool things we're doing this year is having Esri provide us with a hands-on workshop using maps to drive environmental policy. It's a really cool experience. And I think you guys as NEPA practitioners, or you know, just those of you that use GIS, are going to find a lot of value in that. So please stay tuned for that. It's going to be really, really cool. Speaking of, today's episode is sponsored by Esri, which is an innovative, user-centric, research-driven GIS technological company. GIS is particularly critical because everything related to our natural resources is location-based. Whether an environmental agency needs to understand the impact of new development, an agricultural department needs to figure out the most effective approach to control invasive species, or the Department of Fish and Wildlife needs to track migration patterns, GIS can help them improve their decision-making. And Esri is the company to help them do that. And with that, let's get to our show. So, Laura, we had a great interview with Don, and I'm really excited for everybody to listen to it. And Don is an excellent storyteller, right? So we only scratch the surface of the things that she's done and the stories that she has. Like, there is an incredible story that she did, I think with NPR, about her time on a research vessel, like her very first research vessel, where she's the only one of like 10 women out of 110 people and the only Black woman on a ship, and how she makes connections. And it is such a good story that I'm telling you guys, you have to go out and find it and listen to it because it's really inspirational and it's so fun and interesting. But I'm telling you, she's great. I'm really excited about the interview. I don't know, was there something from the interview that you really enjoyed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved everything. Just her being such a down-to-earth person and also being so incredibly smart. You know, we talked a minute about mapping the seafloor and stuff, and the whole concept, I've had this conversation a few times before, and it's always, you know, every time you hear it, it's like, okay, yeah, you can't seem to remember that the cloud of this internet that we are always talking about is actually underwater.
Yeah, and yeah.
So it occurred to me one day, or it came up in a conversation or something, just like, wait a minute, how does this information get to us from across the pond?
Right.
And then you're like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everybody assumes that all of our internet is just wireless and it's everywhere.
Right,
and that's how you get it. It's satellites. Yes. I think so many people think that. And it's actually literally cables. Yeah. Right. But yeah,
that's our next thing. Let's go out on the street and ask people.
Yeah. Start asking. Yeah. Yeah. We'll record that. Yeah.
But anyway, I did this whole rabbit hole research about the underwater cables because it's just fascinating to me. One, that they're there. And two, like, how'd they get there without anybody noticing? Right. We're always talking about the oil pipelines and people can see them and they're like, I don't want that in my backyard. But we all have this in our ocean and like nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Yeah. And what is it? I think there was the very first cable laid was like in the 1850s or something crazy like that.
1858.
Yeah, that's
it lasted
insane.
For 1 month, but it sent a communication.
But it
changed, you know, this has changed our history and where we're at now. But I'm concerned, my issue is not issue, but the thing I wanted to dig up was like, what are the environmental impacts and who are working on these things?
Yeah.
So do you know anything about that? Because doing NEPA or anything? Or like,
so there are
paths with this work?
There are NEPA stuff. I personally haven't. I know there's been a few projects that are related to that. And if it crosses any level of federal jurisdiction, then there is going to be NEPA for that. So You know, like I did actually do a transmission line project from, you know, I think I've talked about it on the show, going from Canada to New York City. So that cable that we did was also the same kind of cable that they do. Just I guess this one was like 6 inches, you know, and I think everybody
has fiber optics, right?
Yeah, it is. And yes, and it's layered with copper and rubber and a few other materials to basically make it tough. They're much smaller than people think.
Yeah.
But they're also like, you know, depending on how it is, the longer they are, the more robust they need to be and where they're going matters. And so there's all kinds of crazy stuff that goes into it. And we actually had to do impact analysis on the electricity that it's emitting. Like, would that impact how fish are behaving, you know? And so there's actually, yeah, there's a lot of effort that has to go into that. And I'm sure the same thing has to happen when you're talking about those international cables as well. It's crazy. But I think it may also depend on who's doing it, right? Because usually it's the tech industry people. Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think, like, if tech industries are the ones putting it in, unless they're getting like funding that's federal, they probably don't have to do NEPA now that I think about it.
Yeah, so that's interesting too. There's a really cool map. Anybody listening, if you look for the underwater sea cables on CNN, there's a cool map that shows where these cables are. Mm-hmm. And then we already talked about when the first cable was put in. So the first cable was just across the Atlantic, I believe.
Yeah.
And that message went from like the US to probably New York City to London. Guess how many miles of cable there are now?
Oh, God. Oh, I love this game. I love this game. No matter what, I'm going to get it wrong. So I don't know. 1,222.
Not quite.
Hey, it's I overdid it.
I mean, not quite close.
Oh,
745,000.
So, oh my God.
Yeah. And who knows when that was. There's more being installed all the time.
Oh my God.
So they're regulated by the FCC. When I looked up who regulates them, I saw nothing about environmental like regulations, which is really scary. And who owns them used to be the telecoms companies.
Mm-hmm.
And more so now it is the Googles and the Amazons and the people who own the network servers and stuff like that.
Right.
So I imagine as you all these youngsters start building up Bitcoin and other things and 5G, that this number will continue to grow. I think, you know, our jobs, anybody out there listening for future jobs who likes marine science, maybe this is an area you can be looking into.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's one of the things talking with Dawn that was so interesting is like, I hadn't really considered that. Yeah. You want to know where you're putting those cables because you don't want to put them on top of a vent where where magma is coming up out of the surface. It's going to ruin the cable. And so it's one of the,
it's really amazing they can find a route all the way across the ocean.
I know. It's crazy.
But then another thing that I discovered is that there's also climate change impacts because the underwater cables are protected, like you said, with all of this material, but where they connect to land. So that's a different kind of permit and where you're probably more likely to do NEPA stuff.
Exactly.
So that those are different. So they're not included. Where they connect to land, that's not included in the numbers I told you. They connect in certain ports and areas, usually high traffic areas, and then they have to convert to ground. So then they go underground. So they're underwater till they're underground.
Okay.
Then they're going wherever they go from there. But the underground places are not water protected. So as sea level rises now, and so when they were first installed, I imagine the newer ones are starting to look at that. But when they were first installed, they were not looking into that. So now there's going to be this whole thing about, we might lose our internet because sea level is rising. So again, jobs.
That's incredible.
I'm glad Dawn brought it up. I'm glad we were able to talk about it today. I'm going to be keeping an eye on it. And some of the research I did said that they've like really the first and only climate impact analysis that had been done was in 2018. So I mean, every article I read led to all the same stuff. We can post some of those things in the details if you want to look into this yourself. There's also a really cool map on internethealthreport.org that actually will let you see where all the connections to ground are and who owns them and stuff. So it's really interesting. So maybe, you can look to see if those companies are hiring for climate impact internet servers.
There you go.
All right. Well, let's get to that interview.
All right. Sounds good. Hello and welcome back to EPR. We are so delighted to be joined by Dr. Dawn Wright, who's the chief scientist of the Environmental Systems Research Institute, better known as ESRI, the world's leading geographic information systems software research and development company. Dawn, thank you so much for being here. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do for ESRI?
Yes. So It's great to be with you on your podcast. And I would love to tell you about what I do at Esri, because I think for environmental professionals, it's good to know that there is a really strong niche for environmental professionals in the IT sector, and especially in the geospatial software industry, because what I do at Esri is not software development. It is not marketing or sales. I basically function as a scientist, as a research scientist for the company. And I am the scientific strategist, you could say, for Jack Dangerman, who's the CEO. I report directly to him. But broadly, what I do is strengthen the scientific foundation for Esri software and services. So I work across all of the different teams at Esri. We are building software for hydrologists and geologists and geophysicists, ecologists, agricultural scientists, ocean scientists, foresters, people in conservation biology, weather and climate, sustainability science is big now, geodesign. Yeah. Many types of social science. And so there needs to be a strong connection with scientists who are actually doing their science with our software, and also a strong connection with the scientific literature and with important committees and trends that are out there. So my job is to make that connection between Esri and those communities. That's an internal function. And then externally, I represent and extend Esri as a member of the scientific community. We are known as a vendor, of course, a software vendor, but we are also a community of scientists within Esri. And we do a lot, quite a lot of work in collaboration with federal and state and local government agencies. We collaborate on scientific projects. We have representation on a lot of boards and councils. And that's a big part of my job, is to be Esri's representative on those boards and councils. Connect with the National Science Foundation, the National Academies of Sciences, the scientific advisory councils of a lot of nonprofits. Many government agencies have their scientific advisory boards. So I do a lot of that work. I don't do all of that work, because a lot of my colleagues do that work as well, but but I do a lot of it. So
I was going to say, that sounds really awesome. It sounds like a lot.
It keeps me off. It keeps me out of trouble, I hope.
I love Esri. I've been working with GIS for, I just happened to stumble into a job that was like, oh, yeah, you're going to do GIS too. And even after my career, I use story maps to do some of my personal adventures. But what are some of your favorite tools and the coolest things you've seen being used for science and environmental work?
Well, the story maps are really up there, because story maps have just skyrocketed as one of the most effective science communication tools. So story maps are among my favorite. And I don't have enough time to do the GIS that I want to do. I used to script and code and develop extensions and apps, and the administrative and speaking and networking ambassador kind of work that I do now. I don't have enough time to get my fingers into ArcGIS Pro, but I can do a story map. So that's among my favorite. But we have also developed several web apps that really point the way to the different types of science that you can learn about, but also science that you can do analytically at a basic level through a web app. And so there are several of these apps that it's hard for me to pick a favorite, but we have different categories of them. And I think I will pick a favorite, because we have all of these Explorer apps. So these are basically web applications that let you take a close-up look at science topics or at actual science observations around the world. And the latest of these is the Mars Explorer app, because that was released by one of our teams in collaboration with NASA JPL in connection with the Perseverance landing on Mars.
Oh, wow. So, and like, full disclosure, I am a huge ocean nerd. Like, I remember when I was a kid, like, one of the coolest discoveries of my lifetime was the chemosynthesis cycle and like deep sea vents, you know, where, like no light, but life finds a way, right? One of the most
absolutely
in the world. And so you studied underwater volcanoes, and I guess, like, how does that relate to Esri and what else you've done on the ocean floor?
Well, first of all, I love the name of your podcast, EPR. Mm-hmm. Because to me, EPR means East Pacific Rise. And the East Pacific Rise was my study site. And it's one of the hot, active places on the ocean floor where we know so much about these hydrothermal vents. Yeah. And we know a lot about them, stemming back to GIS, because when I first got into GIS, what I was trying to do was integrate different types of data so that we could understand hydrothermal vent areas much better. And I think that was part of the origin story of GIS for the oceans, because when you go down to one of those underwater hot springs, mm-hmm. you're trying to understand the geology, because those places form along cracks on the ocean floor, places where magma are coming out of the seafloor, but also very superheated water. The minerals that are in that stream or that jet of water suddenly just fall out and form the vents. The vents are, of course, part of a biological ecosystem as well. So you need to understand geology, chemistry, biology, and even the bottom current. So it's physical oceanography. So those are automatically four layers of information that need to be integrated and need to be mapped simultaneously, overlaid, of course. Mm-hmm. And that is, I used Esri software back in the early 1990s to do that work. And so that type of exploration and that type of integration and the spatial analysis that goes along with it is an integral part of what we do up to today. One of the reasons I was hired at Esri was to get an ocean science initiative off the ground to further improve the software and the services that we produce for the oceanographic community. And one of the first things that was produced around the time of my arrival was a base map. There was already a very fantastic team working on the Esri Ocean base map. And the base map continues to grow in its detail and its accuracy because of a continual work that's going on by the General Bathymetric Chart of the Oceans. And it's part of this big initiative called Seabed 2030, which is to get to the most accurate map of the seafloor, which means that we have to map all of the gaps that have not been covered with surveys. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge international effort, of which Esri is a part, to do that by 2030. So that's a big thing that's been going on. But another big thing is the ability to work in 3 and 4 dimensions. And so now we have voxels, which is a fantastic extra ingredient in our functionality. We know of pixels, especially for those of us who use satellite data, picture elements.
Yeah.
A voxel is simply a volume element. So it's a three-dimensional cube instead of a two-dimensional grid cell.
Right, right.
It's so fascinating to watch this change over the years.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Not just the science and the technology behind it, but Esri itself, you know, I don't remember what version I started with, and I'm sure you started with a version before I did, and just the iterations and every time how the user friendliness of it changes and how
it grows.
They work together with the new solutions, right?
It is amazing to watch, and it's very hard to keep up with. Within Esri, we have a hard time keeping up with it ourselves because Esri functions on teams. And so we have all of the different teams for the different parts of the Esri software ecosystem. And it's been very gratifying to see how communication channels within Esri have increased and improved so that we do really know what's going on across the company and across the platform. This really comes together for us before the user conference, of course, because we have to get everything prepared. And so, especially for our CEO, Jack Dangerman, he spends several weeks getting an overview from all of the different teams as to the latest in our technology, what we have achieved. And he works very, very hard to gather all that information. And he has to be prepared to communicate that because if anyone has been to an Esri user conference, Jack Dangerman has the stage for the first couple of hours just explaining everything that's going on in our platform.
Yeah. And those are broadcast, right? I'm pretty sure you can tune into those either live or after the fact.
Yes. When we were meeting face-to-face, the videos were available, I believe, within 24 hours. Now, and I believe, yes, it's okay for me to say that the Esri User Conference this year will be virtual, so it will be live streamed. And so you can get that live. And the videos, the turnaround on our video production has been quite amazing because everything is so virtual now. So
yeah,
the videos are usually available within 24 hours.
Yeah, I've always found those presentations to be some of the most inspiring and just interesting because you have the visuals to go with the projects.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. You know, I went to the Esri User Conference as a user, as a customer for, almost 20 years. And I would cry at the plenary every year. It was so incredible. Amazing. Yeah, I would be in tears. This is so beautiful. This is so inspiring. Oh my gosh.
I love that. So great.
Nick, did you have other questions about the deep sea? I mean, were you diving?
I'll ask, you know, we've heard a lot like over the years about how the moon is mapped better than the ocean floor. You know, I think we're getting to the point where Mars is going to be mapped better than the ocean floor.
It is. It is already. Yeah.
It is already. So there you go. Mm-hmm. So why is that happening? And why should we really be focusing on, you know, mapping the ocean floor? And how is Esri contributing to that?
Well, Esri is one of the advisors to the Seabed 2030 effort. Mm-hmm. And so we, especially helping the Seabed 2030 and all of the nations and universities and companies that are involved there.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of oceanographers, seafloor mappers on our staff. So we have specialists and they are part of the team that develops ArcGIS bathymetry. With bathymetry, mm-hmm. which is seafloor topography, you're really using a sound as your way of getting the sound is your signal.
Right. Yeah.
Because this is a water planet. Mars exactly. and Venus and the moon, they are not water planets. It's atmospheric from that planetary sense. So satellites, those kinds of sensors can immediately get the totality of the planet's topography.
Right.
Those types of sensors that use electromagnetic energy cannot see through water, though. They can't see through water, at least all the way down to the depth on our planet. So we must use acoustics. We have to use the sound pulses.
Yeah.
And it takes time. We do have a global map of the ocean floor that is derived from satellite altimetry, mm-hmm. but that's an estimate because that particular instrument does the amazing job of estimating the Earth's gravitational signal. And then converting that into places that are deep where there's gravitational pull or gravitational push, where there are mountains, where the topography on the seafloor is pushed up. But if you want the same level of detail in terms of all of the undulations and the cracks and the faults and the plains, everything that you would get with a land topo map, you have to go to sea. You have to put instruments in the water. That takes longer to do that. And right now, our coverage on the seafloor in terms of a rough equivalent in terms of resolution, we have about 19% now of the seafloor mapped at a similar high resolution to the Earth's surface and also to other planets. In fact, it still lags behind other planets. One of our colleagues, Mark Costello, who is an oceanographer who works in Norway, he wrote a very interesting article recently about how other planets are mapped better than our own planet. But we've got to have the importance of the ocean floor and the ocean is absolutely paramount. So we are doing this podcast interview over Zoom that relies on information technology, internet infrastructure. Somewhere there's a submarine cable involved in that. In fact, one broad statement is that we have the internet because of the ocean.
Yeah.
Because we have this global network of submarine cables that is carrying signals. It's carrying Netflix to us and all of the streaming services. It makes it possible for us to have these simulcasts, these webinars with our colleagues in Australia and Africa. Yeah. It's the ocean. And we have a wonderful map and visualization of the global submarine cable network that we have produced.
Wow.
We have, you know, we're dealing with the pandemic.
Yeah.
Still, we're getting there. But yesterday was March 11th, I'll say, was so fascinating. And so such a sad day because of the anniversary of the first day of this pandemic. And I remember March 2020, I couldn't find toilet paper anywhere or some other paper products. Again, it's the ocean. The ocean is responsible for our supply chains. Shipping. We get our paper towels and our toilet paper and our Christmas presents because they come through, they are shipped from overseas, many of those products, and shipping and then trucking on land keeps just about every single thing that we buy that's delivered to us on a cargo ship or a truck. And then finally, there's the issue of protein, fisheries, aquaculture operations. And so Esri works with all within all of these different sectors. We supply them with software. We work along with them on some of these thorny spatial analytical problems. They are part of our community, just as a state and local government and other sectors are. So that was a very long answer, but it was it was an excellent question.
You do so much. It is very, very vastly important. But I would like to know also more about your background and how, you know, you mentioned going to user conferences for 20 years. And how did you get started and were you interested in the environment from the beginning? You know, how did you get here?
Yes. So I grew up in the Hawaiian Islands, so I always start there. And so that's where the ocean came into play. To me, there was no other reality but the ocean. And I grew up in the 1960s, to date myself a bit. So I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau specials every Sunday night on network television. That's all we had was network television. no streaming. There were no cable. There was no internet. So everybody was, we were all watching the same things pretty much. And if you were a child, I checked into the Wonderful World of Disney. And then there was the Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. And then there was bedtime. So along with that, there was, reading books, actual books where you turn the pages. So I was absolutely fascinated with books like such as Treasure Island and Mutiny on the Bounty. And I also liked reading biographies of famous people as well, famous scientists. So I studied all of that and determined to become an ocean scientist. That led me to, and in terms of the parts of the ocean, I was interested in the seafloor, in the rocks, the volcanoes. The Hawaiian Islands are essentially a chain of undersea volcanoes that have reached the surface. So we learned all about that in school. And I'll just fast forward to getting through college. To become an oceanographer, you basically have to major in one science, one environmental science, geology, chemistry, physics, or biology. A lot of people think that oceanography is just marine biology. Marine biology, of course, is very charismatic, extremely important, and it really is, it's sort of a brand for the discipline. But there are the other aspects to the planet and to the ocean, and there are those other disciplines of science that are important. So I went the marine geology route. And fast forward again, after my master's degree, I spent a lot of time at sea on research vessels and was actually involved in about 20 different expeditions where we were taking samples of rocks and sediment from the seafloor and analyzing those. It was called the Ocean Drilling Program. It's still going on. It's called the International Ocean Discovery Program. And so it had a lot of field experience that way, and then decided to go back to school after being at sea for on and off for 3 years and discovered geography. So my deep, dark secret that I'm going to reveal is that I didn't know what GIS even was until I got to my doctoral program. this is back in the early 1990s. Of course, now there are 6 year olds who are hassled with GIS. Every year at our user conference, we have young people who are ranging from elementary to high school age who show our vast audience what they can do with GIS. We had some high school students who were involved in a 4-H program a few years ago, and they picked up ArcGIS Pro just like that, and we're doing all these great analyses. Anyway, I was exposed to GIS and to Esri's technology in the early 1990s. And I ended up being a GIS professor at Oregon State University for about 17 years and teaching GIS and mentoring and advising students doing GIS projects, along with teaching in physical geography and oceanography. So I'll say, though, to wrap this story up, that the GIS community is a wonderful community because I found a real home in GIS and geography. I love the conferences. The first conference I went to, it was not an ESRI conference. It was an old series of conferences called GIS-LIS, Geographic Information Systems, Land Information Systems. And my friend and I, we went through the exhibit portion of that conference. And unlike other conferences I had been to in geology or oceanography or other basic science conferences, this exhibit area was fun. I mean, it was really fun because we just walked up and down the aisles and that people kept giving us free stuff, keychains and globes and all kinds of baubles and pens. I thought, this is awesome. I want to be in this community. I want to be with these GIS and geography people. And there was such a spirit of friendliness. Not that other places are not like that, but it was just really, it really came to the fore of, and it made an initial very big impression on me in terms of the openness and the fun and the, I'll say, the diversity of the community, because people come to GIS from all different backgrounds and all kinds of different environmental sciences. Yeah. So from that dimension of diversity is, I think, very, very strong.
Yeah, I think that's part of what's being missed with the virtual. We don't get the handouts and the goodies and the welcome, come to my booth. Let's talk a while.
Gosh, it's so hard. But, you know, it's crazy. You mentioned diversity and how, you know, GIS plays into so many different things. Like many of our listeners are on the policy side of the environment, right? And so I don't know if there's a way that environmental policy influences what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, yes. In fact, I was just involved with a fantastic story maps, a short course that was taught at the Harvard Kennedy School about the Arctic and about all of the climate change issues associated with the Arctic. And it was a fantastic group of students because some of them were environmental scientists, but many of them were policy students, law students, journalists, artists coming from across the Harvard Kennedy School, the Graduate School of Design at Harvard, and other parts of the university. They were working with the Woodwell Climate Research Institute, which and still is closely connected with the work of John Holdren. He's now at Harvard, but he was President Obama's science advisor, and he ran the White House Office of Science, Technology, and Policy. So there is a huge, huge linkage there between especially the work that I do, because I have served stints on NOAA's Science Advisory Board, EPA Science Advisory Board while at ESRI. Right now, ESRI is supporting the Biden-Harris administration in various ways. We did quite a bit of work to help during their transition.
Yeah.
And especially with climate being one of the huge issues, it's on President Biden's agenda.
Yeah.
His executive orders have spoken to the need for preserving biodiversity. So there's the preserving 30% of biodiversity by 2030. That is one of his executive orders. And so all of that, these are all spatial issues where are we going to best preserve biodiversity? How can we ensure economic stability? Where can people get jobs in this new climate? I'll use that term, climate of alternative energy. How are we going to ensure that people who are from certain sectors are able to retrain and keep their stay employed jobs? The pandemic, in terms of supporting vaccination and testing sites, where should those sites be set up?
Yeah.
How are they connected to communities of color, disadvantaged communities?
Yes.
How can we remove the injustice that is associated with all of these heavy burdens always falling on communities of color. The essential workers are mainly from communities of color or from the lower income parts of our society. Mm-hmm. Again, these are all spatial questions and they require spatial analysis. They require good authoritative spatial data. So that's right in our wheelhouse. And then how are you going to communicate these issues and communicate what it is that you hope to do and how you want to do it?
Yeah.
All together now, story maps. So
of course.
Oh, story maps.
I love that. I love it. That's such a
I just want to take a second to mention that story maps is free.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyone can go. You don't need to buy Esri software. So students out there, you need to set yourself apart and do a project. It's free.
And user friendly.
It's a great way to start learning it.
Yeah. It's easy to use. It really is.
Yeah. And a lot of what we are producing at Esri now, we are producing it so that all you need is a web browser and a good internet connection.
Yeah.
So this is what we call, in part, the web GIS pattern. And even in terms of getting data, we're trying to get, especially many of these federal agencies in the state and local government, all across all sectors, we are used to getting a big old terabyte file on an FTP site and trying to download and break that apart and deal with it. And for many, many of these scenarios now, you don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah.
The data are stored in the cloud. There's a web service that represents that data, and you work by linking these web services together. And basically what you're doing is you're taking your analysis. You might download a workflow or an approach or an algorithm, but you can take that up into the cloud. So story maps indeed are free, but there are a lot of other parts of the Esri ecosystem that are free as well, and that also play well with open source.
Yeah.
That's another message that we've been trying to get out for many, many years. A lot of our technology is developed in open source, and the language that we play in or that we work in is Python, do a lot of JavaScript, and we have all of these application programming interfaces or APIs that you can do to connect things together, not unlike Lego bricks.
Yeah.
So a lot of us at Esri are Lego fans.
Yes.
Which is a seamless segue to our next question. I love that you're fond of Legos, and it's such a great thing. And I remember, like,
I think she's beyond fond of Legos.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
Yeah, it's pretty serious.
Yeah. Maybe it's an addiction, but we'll leave that for the next time we talk. But I love it. It's like, ironically, like my favorite set as a kid was like Deep Sea Pirates for whatever reason.
Oh, yes.
Right? I loved that. And they had like little submarines that looked like sharks. And it was just one of those things I could put together with blindfolded, you know, like with one hand, you know. And I just, Legos are so fun. And I guess it's funny because it makes me like feel like I can put together any piece of IKEA furniture. Like that's the best application I have.
Yes.
Like, but it's so great. Like, what drew you to Legos and why do they have such staying power? Why is it so fun?
Yeah, well, this is a podcast, so the audience is not going to be able to see the way you can see behind me.
The
Brick Beard's Bounty and the Queen Anne's Revenge with the Lego sharks, all of that is sitting behind me. There's a yellow submarine under my left shoulder. And so many of us played with Lego as kids and used the Lego blocks to create adventures. But Lego now is a completely different entity. Well, for me, I just love the company. You know, it starts with the company's values. And I started really getting into building with Lego bricks during my PhD to preserve my sanity. So I would take some time off, you know, after getting through my PhD qualifying exams or after getting back from a long stint in the field. And if I had a few days off, I would build a Lego pirate ship.
Yeah,
because at that time, that was the theme that they were selling. And of course, I was enamored with that. So I started with Lego pirate ships. Now it's the Lego Star Wars. They have been very smart in terms of capturing these themes.
Yeah.
There's already an idea for the Lego Perseverance rover. That is probably going to be a product very soon.
Yeah, that's so cool.
But if you study the history of the company, the meaning of the word Lego in Danish, to play well, the purity of their purpose, even the fact now that their product is plastic, which is problematic with the problem that we have with plastic on this planet. Yeah. But they're working very hard now to come up with a new material that they can make their bricks out of.
Oh, wow.
In fact, they have a prototype right now that is made out of sugarcane. So wow. It would be the equivalent of plastic bricks, but made out of sugarcane. At any rate, they are just a fun company. Yeah. And if anybody has been to Legoland, right. enough said.
Right.
and the Lego movies. So
oh, I loved it. Yeah,
I love the brand, and I love all of the different kits. I'm actually not very good as an engineer. I must follow the instructions to the T. But I love the fact that the instructions are there. There's not a word in sight. It's very visual, and you have to study. If you want the kit to come out the way that it's intended, you have to, to concentrate. And I love that level of concentration that's required. For me, it's actually relaxing. And all of the way that these kits are designed, it's just fabulous. And then there are other people who are true artists, like my colleague, John Nelson, who is able to create, or Kenneth Field. Kenneth Field has put together an entire globe made out of thousands of Lego bricks. Wow. And John Nelson has created an ArcGIS Pro cartographic style so that you can brickify the maps that you make in ArcGIS
That's so
Pro.
Cool.
So those guys are true artists.
right.
But it's just really wonderful. And there are, you know, it's a thing. There's an AFOL, an adult fan of Lego, and they have their conferences, their meetings, their documentaries about this. It's pretty, pretty serious.
I love it.
That's awesome. Well, you can check out Don's collection, if you will, on Flickr. I looked at that. We can also share that link if you want to, Don.
Oh, yes. That would be fun.
I
enjoyed looking at it, and I was really, really, you know, knew you were overly fond when you had a Lego with your own of yourself.
Oh, no. You know, I value that more than my PhD. That is the work of a wonderful friend, Joe Kenyon. Joseph Kenyon and I have never met, but he's involved with the Society for Conservation GIS. He works as a GIS analyst up in Sonoma County, and he is a specialist in minifigs. So that's the creating people in Lego. We follow each other on Twitter. I think that's how this started. And so he sent to me in the mail my own Deep Sea Dawn minifig and a marine GIS lab to go with it.
Oh, that's
so he
cool.
sent me the pieces so that I could rebuild it. And so it's on my Twitter account, and it's other places. But that is, to me, the most awesome gift, to be Lego-fied as a minifig.
Yeah.
He recently sent me a Jack Dangerman minifig.
Oh, that's
great. So that went up on Twitter. In fact, and it's okay, Jack Dangerman, he really likes it. So,
Okay, so coming up next, Ezri, the Lego movie.
Yeah, right, yeah. Starring Don Wright, yeah.
Rick Dangerman.
Yeah.
I mean, his name is made for movies. I don't
that
know.
Is true. He does have a great laugh.
Yeah.
Well, Don, this has been awesome. You're so much fun to talk to, and
absolutely.
We could talk to you for hours and hours, but we're out of time. So thank you so much. Is there anything else that you want to tell listeners or any other resources you want to point people to?
Oh, well, this has been really fun, and the time did go way, way, way too fast.
I know.
But for your environmental professional listeners out there, we do have this wonderful portfolio of resources that we keep updated very, very carefully. It's called the Ezri Science Portfolio. And listeners can go to www.esri.com/sciences.
Oh.
And it has the page of the maps and apps that I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And we have initiatives there covering open science, weather and climate science, ocean science, solid earth science, which would be hydrology, geology, ecology, all of the land-based ologies, geographic information science, or geospatial. We are also calling it spatial data science now.
Yeah.
And then finally, social science. And that's especially where the issues of racial equity, the interface with policy, There are links to our policy maps there, issues of homelessness, COVID, all of that. So anyway, our six initiatives, open, weather and climate, ocean, solid earth, GI science, and social science. So it's a very, very rich site. It also points to our events and news items, all of the latest, and tons of resources. So I really hope that your listeners can check that out and enjoy that as well. And it's been a real, real pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much. We look forward to talking to you again.
Same here.
All right. Thanks, Dawn.
Bye.
Bye. I just wanted to say, like, huge thanks to Dr. Dawn Wright for being here with us. It was so fun to have her on. Such a brilliant mind, really great insight and perspective. I mean, yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah. She's not only a brilliant mind, she's just super nice and down to earth.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. Which is so great. I love when we have those connections with people. It's so fascinating. I love it. All right. Well, that's our show, everybody. So I guess we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.